Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about race. That is a conversation, of course, that is occurring quite frequently now here in America, and a conversation which is occurring, in a sense, with new or renewed intensity. And in many places that perhaps where those conversations have not taken place in the same way before. And I'm very, very happy that this conversation today can revolve around a very compelling new book called Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and the Story of Reconciliation. This is a story that revolves around a terrible massacre in which it's believed well over 100 African Americans were killed in the early fall of 1919. And the grandfather of my guest, J. Chester Johnson, was a participant in that massacre that occurred over the course of some days. And J. Chester Johnson's own personal journey to understand what happened at the Elaine Race Massacre and his grandfather's participation in it, and the question of how such a thing could be possible, and his connection with a descendant of someone who was a victim of that massacre is at the heart of this story of redemption and new understanding. And this book could not be more beautifully timed, more appropriate for some of the conversations that we are having right now as a nation. The book again is titled Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation, published by Pegasus. And J. Chester Johnson, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm very pleased to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I didn't mention in my introduction that you are a gifted writer in a number of different respects, especially well known as a poet. Your biography tells us that you're also an essayist and a translator. Part of your own kind of journey of discovery came back in 2008, when I believe you were asked to write something for the Episcopal Church for a special national day of repentance. That might be a good place for us to begin our conversation. Explain what that National Day of Repentance was about and how in preparing the statement which you were asked to write, how you came to know about the Elaine Race Massacre.
Well, thank you very much. In 2008, as you indicated, I was asked to write the Litany of Offense and Apology for this Day of Repentance, which was October the 4th, 2008, when the Episcopal Church formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. And during the course of my research, as I was preparing this litany, which is the basic document of this formal apology, I came across a treatise of about 70 pages written by the African-American historian and anti-lynching advocate Ida B. Wells. And it was entitled The Arkansas Race Riot of 1919. It describes this terrible event where over 100 African-Americans were slaughtered in rural Arkansas, Southeast Arkansas, along the Mississippi River Delta. in an area, a county called Phillips County, which was right on the Mississippi, which is on the Mississippi, and has very rich soil and conducive to the cotton growing. I grew up one county removed from Phillips County, and I never heard about this event. Neither had my friends with whom I grew up in this county. There were two elements of it. One is I was fascinated by the event itself, but also I was a little angry that I grew up in this, in the general area, and no one ever talked about this event. And I said, I've really got to find out more about it. And during the course of my research, I discovered not only a great deal about this massacre, but also the fact that my grandfather worked for the Missouri Pacific Railroad, and the Missouri Pacific Railroad was up to its eyeballs in this event. I discovered that he had participated in it, and that set me on a course that led eventually, as you referred to, a person named Sheila Walker. And Sheila Walker had a number of antecedents who were victims of this massacre, two great uncles, grandmother, and a great grandmother. And she had also been fascinated by this event. She had heard snippets about it over the course of her life. And a mutual friend of ours, who's a writer, thought it would be fascinating and also of enduring importance for the two of us to get together. And so in the in early 2014, Sheila Walker and I we had a phone call first, about 2 hours, and then we met in their son's home up in Boston. And without necessarily articulating this sort of formal term of racial reconciliation, we just over time became very good friends and abiding friendship over the long term. And our respective spouses have become part of it. Our children have become part of it. And it's really been a fascinating journey. And if you want me to expand on that, I certainly can.
We'll certainly get into that. Let's speak about what happened back in 1919 in a little more depth. Although one of the things we need to say here at the outset is that there is much that remains to some extent shrouded in mystery about exactly what happened in 1919. And one of the chief questions is exactly how many African Americans lost their lives, how many were murdered. But let's talk first about what we do know about what happened. And one of the things I appreciate about your book is that you give us some historical context about what was going on at that point in time that created this atmosphere of fear, which really helped spark this event. Tell us in particular about the many African-American veterans who returned home from World War I and the way in which that sort of created a very, very different scenario from what had existed before.
Well, this massacre occurred soon after the end of World War I. And many African-Americans had participated as soldiers in World War I in Europe, and a number of them were heroes and had been treated with considerable respect in Europe. And when they returned to the shores of the United States, they expected that their and they would be treated with more respect and with more equity than the way they were treated prior to leaving the United States. In response, actually, the white nation of America rose up and said this was not going to happen. And so there were outbreaks in what has become known as the Red Summer of 1919, with racial conflicts from Arizona to the Northeast and with all spots in between. But there was no place worse than the Mississippi River Delta at that time in terms of this response by whites, African Americans. Also going on at this time was some fear of Bolshevikism because of the Russian Revolution that previously occurred and the world domination and union, the precipitating factor to move toward communism was unionization and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, as we move into the Mississippi River Delta, we have to realize that cotton prices had been raised substantially as a result of World War I and its aftermath to a level that no one had previously predicted. So the sharecroppers were really anxious to get their fair share. Bear in mind that sharecropping was sort of an upgraded version of slavery. That is, one would bring the African Americans would bring the cotton to the white planter and get a certain price, but the price was never right at the market. Whatever the price was, they sold their cotton at that level. They would get the proceeds. They would go to the commissary, which is effectively where they got all their foodstuffs, that sort of stuff, and pay off their debt. But more often than not, they would still have a debt above the amount that they had paid, which in sharecropping law and structure, if you had debt, you couldn't leave the land. So there was this process that was very onerous for African Americans. So there was a group of sharecroppers within Phillips County in a place called Hoop Spur, which was north of Elaine. They decided to unionize, and the Progressive Farmers and Household Union, on the night of September the 30th, 1919, they met in Hoop Spur Church, about 100 sharecroppers and their families. At 11 o'clock, the deputy sheriff comes with Missouri Pacific Railroad agent, and they fire into the church to try to disturb it. And disturb the meeting. Not unbeknownst to them, the union had hired guards. And, the guards fired back. The Missouri Pacific Railroad agent was killed. The deputy sheriff was shot in the knee. And that was a precipitating factor that led to the next several days of the massacre. And I can go into that your will.
So we're talking about, in a sense, reprisal killings for what happened on that night, and over the course of some days, we're talking about very likely more than 100 African Americans in that region being killed by various posses and even by federal troops who are ultimately brought into the area. One of the factors that connects you very directly to this, as I think I touched on in the introduction, is that your grandfather was one of the people who was one of the whites who was one of the participants in this wave of killings. Although I don't think you know that literally he was responsible for any murders. I don't believe so, but you know that he, as a member of the Ku Klux Klan at the time, was a part of this. Explain to our listeners how you came to understand that your grandfather had been part of this massacre.
Well, there were a number of factors that came together. One, my mother and I used to travel to Little Rock, where my maternal grandparents lived in the 1950s. They had moved from Deschutes County, which is the county right below Phillips County, Phillips County being the site of this massacre. He worked for the Missouri Pacific Railroad, as I indicated, in the hub. The Missouri Pacific Railroad hub was McGee, Arkansas, in Deschutes County, and he worked there for most of his career. But he had been moved to Little Rock, which is the center of the operations. My father died when I was one, and my mother didn't do particularly well. And so I lived with my maternal grandparents, and my grandfather, Lonnie, was particularly attentive to me. He was my 24-hour-a-day caretaker, and we were very close. Then roll forward a few years, and my mother and I used to drive to Little Rock from our small town of Monticello in southeast Arkansas, which where my mother had brought my older brother and me into one household when I just started the school. But Little Rock Central integration crisis occurred in 1957, and my mother and I used to go to Little Rock and spend time with my grandparents, and they lived only three blocks from Little Rock Central. So, and it was a national event. It was very focused also on the state. So we talked about race issues a lot, driving back and forth. And in those discussions, my mother would tell me about this event that Lonnie had participated in, a well-known race riot, she called it. And she told me a lot about it. Well, I didn't make very many connections until I stumbled on this through Ida B. Wells. And as I did further research, I decided, all right, I'm going to check on what was going on in southeast Arkansas at that particular time. Well, there were lynchings, yes, of African Americans. There were burning alive of African Americans. But this, there was only one or two at a time. The only massacre that actually occurred was in the Elaine race massacre, and that was it. So, and when you took into account that there were so many connections between the Missouri Pacific Railroad and this massacre, and it occurred very close to my grandfather's farm, his role in Missouri Pacific Railroad, the way in which my mother described the typography that she knew about and that Lonnie had talked about, the place with the killing fields, one thing led to another. And so that I eventually concluded that the well-known race massacre or well-known race riot that my mother talked about and the Elaine race massacre, one and the same.
Right. And I want to just clarify for our listeners that you have this conversation with your mother. This is back in the 1950s.
Right.
That you are first learning that your grandfather had been part of some well-known race riot. It is 2008 before right. You first learn of the Elaine race massacre. So right. You are tying these things together over the course of a half century.
Right.
I mean, that's part of what makes this story particularly amazing, I think.
Yeah, it also makes it somewhat poignant because it has this, you know, that I had lived with this knowledge, but I had no place to put it over this period of time, because she talked about it on more than one occasion. And she also referred to the fact that he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan when she was small, and he would leave with his hood and his sheet and hood and come back several hours later and really not talking about what had happened while he was away. But that wasn't the case, apparently, with this well-known race riot that she referred to. But he did discuss this with my mother and other family members. And it was fascinating, because the first time I went to the killing fields, it was as though she had painted this picture of the event and the terrain and the cotton rows and where so many African Americans were killed. And I knew that was it.
One of the things that you had to come to grips with was how such a thing could be possible with your grandfather, Lonnie, who had demonstrated such tremendous kindness towards you and this man that you loved so dearly. How could a man who also wore a Ku Klux Klan hood and involved himself in this terrible event, how could he be the same man who loved you so tenderly as a grandfather? At one point in the book you write, "I cannot reconcile my love for Lonnie and his apparent views about and contributions to racism." And then you go on to say, maybe he couldn't reconcile the two either. I'm so glad that you talk about this, because I think most of us, when we look at photographs or film footage or whatever of the Ku Klux Klan and learn about the terror that they unleashed, we imagine them to be monsters and nothing but monsters. And of course, there's something monstrous about who they were and what they did. But you are painting this picture of somebody who could also be very kind. I think you wrote the words I read fairly early in this story. Are you still at that point of trying to reconcile how this kindly grandfather could be this, in a sense, other person as well? Have you come to understand how such a thing is possible?
Well, there's a way of intellectually understanding conceptually those two personalities, the loving grandfather, the one who effectively rescued me and when I was one, and the gunman who participated in this event. I thought early on, as I was doing my research and as I was in several years later, as I wrote a very long article that eventually evolved into a portion of this book, Damaged Heritage, that I could somehow bring those two together. And I have tried for these over these many years now, since 2008, and I have been famously unsuccessful at bringing the two together. He's effectively this bifurcated figure. But what is a fascinating aspect of this is that Sheila doesn't have the same problem that I have. She has, in 2004, we were part of a symposium on this massacre. And she got up, and we were in the midst of our reconciliation, been working on it for some time. She got up and she said, "I forgive Lonnie, and I forgive him more than Chester does. I believe that," this is Sheila talking, "I believe that people are born good, but there are bad circumstances that cause good people to do bad things." And she has a piece about it that I don't have. Now, her ability to say that removed a whole shadow over a potential relationship and created the ability for us to have an abiding friendship that I don't think we would have been able to have. But I haven't gotten there, and there are several reasons. One is that I don't think white folks do as well with forgiveness as African Americans do. I know that when Dylan Roof had killed all those people at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, and several weeks later the families forgave him, and so many white people were astonished at it. I haven't gotten there. Sheila's view also, just to add, is that he was a loving and compassionate man. Otherwise, I wouldn't have cared for him the way that I did, or responded in the way that I did. But he didn't know. There's a phrase that I use in the book called the genuinely human, and that is commonality of people regardless of race and accent and customs and traditions and that sort of thing. And so I refer to it as the genuinely human. And she says that Lonnie would have wanted to pursue the genuinely human in other people if he knew how, and he just didn't know how.
Right.
I think that's a very generous interpretation.
Another line that from Sheila that you quote that I think speaks very much to that is at one point when she says that she sees Lonnie as a prisoner of his time. Right. And I think that's such an interesting way to think about it. And in some ways, it's easier to think about that then than it is now. But the fact is probably to some extent it's true even now that there are certain people who are locked in certain racist attitudes that they don't even understand are there. And it is in a sense because they are prisoners of a particular time or a particular perspective that they are not even aware of.
Right. Maybe some people would say it's unconventional view on some of this. And that is, I actually believe that people who subjugated blacks or have done so over so many generations, it's a complex issue, but that they knew that what they were doing was wrong. Yes, it was of the moment. They knew it was wrong. So why did they do it? Well, what caused them? Well, there are economic factors that for cheap and free labor, the white supremacy and white privilege is available. There are those factors, but there's also the fact that there was this thing that is this excessive veneration for the past that has latched on to generations of American whites, particularly in the South, but not just in the South. We know that they're racist throughout the country, but that they feel as though it would virtually be heresy if they didn't follow in the same perspective, the same customs and traditions that their grandfathers and grandmothers, their parents had toward these events and toward African Americans. And Webster puts a 50-cent word on it called filial pietism. And I think that filial pietism has been employed without filial pietism. I don't think that we would have had this unending cycle of racism, over 400 years of this reoccurring and similar views that get perpetrated from generation to generation.
Right. I think the insight there is that I think some of us, in trying to understand the pervasive racism of certain white Southerners, can understand how they saw the fabric of their society dependent on, for instance, the institution of slavery, and that they envisioned the whole thing just come crashing down if you take out that notion of slavery. So we're talking about economic and societal calamity if that is changed. But I don't think most of us think about this other layer of it, the filiopietism, that idea that the past is something to cherish, our traditions are something to hold on to with great ferocity, and not just because of the practical benefits that they might represent or the stability that they might give us in a practical sense, but that there's something even deeper, more visceral going on,
right,
in terms of an inability to let go of certain traditions, even if those traditions are at their very heart evil and inhumane.
Right, and it, this element, filiopietism, gave, say, in changing, just using different words, say what you were saying, but they served to excuse, to camouflage, and effectively to inoculate generations of whites against the terror of damaged heritage, that in some ways damaged heritage would not have existed in the absence of filiopietism. And because it was so terrible, and they knew it was wrong, but there was this sort of overwhelming effect of filiopietism that existed. Now, you know, probably the most filiopietistic writer that we've had is William Faulkner, and yet he recognized the terror that a combination of damaged heritage and filiopietism represented. And he had a quote from Intruder in the Dust that no man causes more grief than that one who clings blindly to the vices of his ancestors.
Mm.
And that brings both of the elements of damaged heritage and filiopietism together. So I'm not unique in determining. I just put some words on it that haven't been employed, generally speaking, to the issue of American racism, white American racism.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with J. Chester Johnson about his remarkable book, called Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. Much of the book centers on this terrible incident from September of 1919, when well over 100 African Americans were murdered, and a small handful of whites murdered as well in this outbreak of violence and terror. And J. Chester Johnson's grandfather, a member of the Ku Klux Klan at the time, was one of the participants in that massacre. The story of this book is partly the story of his connection with one Sheila Walker, who was a descendant of several people who were victims of that massacre. We should also mention, although I don't think we're going to have much time to talk about this, is that the significance of this massacre is not just its sort of enormity, but also the fact that from it ultimately sprang a very important decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, Moore versus Dempsey, which would have very important ramifications, and which, in your words, broke a long chain of Supreme Court decisions brutally adverse to the safety and rights of African Americans. Briefly, I'm afraid, tell our listeners the significance of Moore versus Dempsey, which sprang out of the legal woes of some African Americans who found themselves charged with murder in the wake of this massacre.
And six of those who were charged with murder, a case came out of those with through a remarkably brilliant African American attorney from Little Rock by the name of Scipio Africanus Jones, whose memory I dedicate this book to. It made its way through the court system, ultimately to the Supreme Court. Now, with the backdrop that we discussed earlier, that there were all these racial conflicts going on throughout the country, there had been pressure applied to the Supreme Court to change its views. They had, for historically, the Supreme Court had determined that civil rights could be determined by each individual state's determination of what civil rights would be within those states. Well, as these conflicts and massacres and events happened, by 1923, we'd also had the Tulsa massacre, as well as Elaine and all this. And there, and one justice felt particularly strong that the federal court system should intercede on unfair trials. Well, there was a very unfair trial that these six sharecroppers had endured, and they were found guilty. And so while we had had, let me just back for a moment. In 1868, the country passed an amendment to the Constitution that required equal justice under the law. Notwithstanding that, the Supreme Court had continued to say states will determine what civil rights are of individuals within those states. By 23, Oliver Wendell Holmes had really been able to convince the other members of the Supreme Court that where there were unfair trials, state and local jurisdictions, the federal government had to provide relief to those who had been found guilty. And in Moore versus Dempsey, and he wrote the majority opinion, 6-2, that's what is stated. And it is my view, and I'm not alone, that was really the beginning of the civil rights movement. It undermined the power of Jim Crow. And if you look at Brown versus Board of Education, equal justice under the law is sprinkled all through that. And it derives its power from the Moore versus Dempsey opinion. In fact, there was a book written in 2014 called Civil Rights in the Making of the Modern American State. And it is absolutely focused throughout the book on Moore versus Dempsey. So it has been overlooked, but that's the silver lining of the Elaine Race Massacre.
I want to be sure to give you a chance to touch on one of my favorite chapters in your book, which is chapter 5, Monticello, Arkansas, in which you talk about your earliest childhood. And we should go on to say that your book also tells us about from that point on, what it was like for you to grow up through your high school years and through the college years and so on, as a white Southerner during the days of the civil rights movement and your observations and so on. But I was especially touched by your account of what happened in the summer of 1950 when you found yourself almost accidentally playing with some African-American boys who lived not far from you. You described this scenario in which they were playing over there and you were kind of by yourself playing in your yard, and these African-American boys would notice you and at some point began finding reasons to reduce the proximity between us. In other words, they would kind of sneak a little closer and a little closer. You'd sneak a little closer and a little closer till eventually you were playing together. These African-American boys and you, the only white. And you suggest, after you've kind of described this to us, that there are probably ways in which this experience opened your perspective and consciousness in a way that at the time you surely had no awareness of whatsoever. I wonder what you think of that now as you look back on these early encounters that you had in Monticello, Arkansas.
Well, thank you for asking about that. It was, I think that experience had a continuing effect on my attitudes thereafter. I can't say that it was the determining factor that caused me to come to all of the conclusions I came to in my activism and Black liberation and that sort of thing, but it was clearly formative. There's no question about it. And I think back over time and I realized, for example, I played Little League. There wasn't a Little League for black children, but I played Little League. And I remember that my favorite baseball bat that I used was Larry Doby. And who was Larry Doby? People don't realize, but he was the American League version of Jackie Robinson. And he played for the Cleveland Indians, first African American. And I look back on that and I said, why did I do that? Well, I think in some ways it was an homage to the friendship that I had with a number of African American boys that I played with early on in my life. But institutional segregation, of course, pulled us apart.
Mm. I appreciate how you say, in fact, that's exactly one of the quotes I'd written down that I especially appreciated. You know, by the time you get to high school, basically all your friends are white. And you say, in hindsight, I can see the effects of segregation encouraging de facto acceptance of racism, if not encouraging racism itself, just encouraging the acceptance of it, which is something that I think we're coming to grips with. But I want to ask you about something from two pages later, which I think is a very powerful statement. You say, throughout my childhood growing up, I felt I was a little less white than my white friends. Although I think that's not something you were particularly conscious of at the time. It's more in retrospect that you understood that about yourself. I think that's so important because I think for certain Americans today who are clinging to racist attitudes again without even realizing it, I think that is something that is very frightening to them, this notion that somehow we as white Americans are being asked to be less white, as though that is some kind of a loss, or if such a thing can be possible. But I wonder if you can tie that into this current situation in which we find ourselves, in which we are continuing to examine racism as it is playing out in 2020.
Well, I hadn't really thought of it in those terms. I've thought of it mainly in terms of how I realize in retrospect that I just didn't, and there was something about that background that I had with African Americans that somehow it just didn't coordinate with so many of the white experiences that I had. There wasn't, in other words, there wasn't this division, this massive division that exists in let's call it the genuinely human, that seemed to be part of was sort of implicit in the way in which people responded. I just never felt that I wasn't convinced of it. I know that from looking at it retrospectively, that I was not convinced of this sort of massive gulf that exists between people of different races. I just knew it. I mean, it just didn't. And I actually think that had a lot to do. I think the book discusses the fact that after Martin Luther King, and I'm getting to your point, that Martin Luther King was murdered, I felt an obligation to go back. I was living in New York, and go back to the Mississippi River Delta and teach in an all African American school, 6th through the 12th grades, before there was integration of the system. And I think there was something that I can't articulate it, but it was that drew me with, because of the view that I had, and that view had evolved out of my relationships with African Americans when I was very young. But this, I like the way you framed this in terms of we are at a point in time where there is fear of certain coalescence of African American and white lives, which I look at it in a celebratory way. We have so much to gain from each other's experience and background and perception, and to get along in that way. It's an extraordinary opportunity. And the obverse viewpoint of racist is pluralism. And the pluralism that we can enjoy in this country, and what this country's ideals would suggest to its citizenry, is exactly what is happening. And that is the merger of so much coalescence that the African American movement and protest today represent. And I celebrate it. It's not, the quicker all of this happens, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Your book outlines much of your own life's journey, the beautiful reconciliation that you have enjoyed with one Sheila Walker. And your book also, among other things, tells the story of the construction of a memorial to the victims of the Alain Race Massacre, a memorial which was just erected last year. And your book explores that and much, much more in beautiful, illuminating fashion. The book again, Damaged Heritage, The Alain Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation, published by Pegasus. The author, J. Chester Johnson. Mr. Johnson, I've really appreciated not only reading your remarkable book, but having this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. It is 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. We'll be joining NPR for the news in about 1 minute. Then we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio